This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Malcolm X had the strength, the will, and the vision to recreate himself. He grew up in a detention home, became a street hustler and drug dealer, then had an intellectual, political, and spiritual awakening in prison, which led him to become a Muslim and a black nationalist. His autobiography inspired millions of readers to find strength in their own identities. Now Malcolm X is being reinvented again in the new movie by Spike Lee. The movie is reminding many people of the important influence Malcolm X has had on their lives, and it's introducing a new generation to his story. My guest Gerald Early has a personal essay about Malcolm X in the December issue of Harper's. Early is the chair of the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis, and he's the editor of a forthcoming book on ethnicity and race in America. Early told me why, when he read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he felt it was the only book written expressly for him, a young black American male.
Oh, because it was very urban book. The only other book I remember reading as a child, as an adolescent that I identified with by a black writer that was autobiographical was Black Boy. But I wasn't able to. I totally identified with that because Richard Wright was from Mississippi. I had never set foot in the South. But Malcolm's life was a northern urban life. I mean, he spent most of his youth in Lansing and in Boston and then in New York. So I think that's one of the major reasons I identified with it, because it seems so much the story of a northern black male and. You know, I'm a northern black male.
You were from Philadelphia?
From Philadelphia.
So how did you discover the autobiography?
Well, my family is pretty politically active, and my sister, my oldest sister, was involved in the civil rights movement. And when that book first came out, I remember it being in our home. And so that's how I got around to eventually reading. I don't recall a time during the time from that time that book was first published onward that a copy, if not more than one copy, was not in my mother's home.
Which parts of Malcolm's life did you most relate to?
I would say I mostly related to the early years up until the time that he had the conversion to Islam. I was even able to relate to the conversion of Islam because the conversion was largely intellectual conversion. It was largely being attracted to adapting a whole bunch of new habits about yourself. In some ways, his conversion was sort of like what a young man would go through if you joined the Marine Corps. And his prison experience and doing the Islam thing was kind of like a Marine Corps sort of experience. And so I was able to identify with that a great deal, and I'm able to identify a great deal with his early life. The feeling of being alienated, the feeling of finding the street life to be attractive. I was never a part of any kind of street life, but I found it when I was a young man to be attractive. I mean, it seemed an awfully, hustlers and people like that seemed awfully attractive people. All those aspects I found enormously appealing in the autobiography.
Did it give you confidence to be yourself or to allow yourself to change, much as Malcolm X had transformed himself?
Yes, it did, and it particularly through books, because the thing that struck me most about the conversion was that it was intellectual. I mean, he converted through books, and he listed a whole bunch of books in that chapter. And I remember going to the library to track down those books. I remember trying to find J. Roger Sex and Race and trying to find Herodotus and all that stuff, and tracking down that stuff and wanting to read it. I think that was the biggest thing about it, was that because I was a kind of studious boy, I think no one had ever quite framed for me the possibility that intellect and reading could give you that kind of power as Malcolm did.
Yeah, well, reading and being an intellectual is usually considered pretty uncool when you're young.
Yeah, but he made it seem cool, and also, you have to remember that I was first introduced to Malcolm not even through this book, but through his speeches and having seen him on TV. And he made being learned and pursuing books very attractive to me. You know, after I read the autobiography, I said, well, you know, if you read books and then you wind up having talking with the kind of authority, with the kind of moral authority and the kind of moral imperative in your voice that Malcolm has, then there really is something to be said about reading, and there really is something to be said about intellect, and there really is something to be said that it has some kind of effect or power to do something in this world that has kind of effect in this world, which with something like Richard Wright, where he also talked about becoming an intellectual and Black boy, it wasn't the same thing because it was all personal. I mean, it was all sort of personal, I want to be a writer and this sort of thing. It wasn't sort of, you know, from out of this, the world is going to really, you know, you can really make some kind of impact in the world through your mind. But it was Malcolm who really convinced me that you could make an impact in the world through your mind.
Did your friends share this with you? Did they read the book? Did they also have a sense that reading and speaking well could have this incredible power?
Not particularly, no. I mean, they weren't into this. You know, the years that we're talking about here, 65 and 66. And no, most of my friends really didn't connect up. In fact, they really didn't connect up with Black Power or any of those things. That didn't come until a few years later, like 68 and 69. It's very funny. I came from a Black working class background, what Martin Kilson would call the tertiary elite, to use his rather learned term. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about people who were hospital orderlies, people who worked in meatpacking plants, construction laborers, people who worked in barbershops or owned barbershops, beauticians. And this was the class of Black people I grew up with. And, you know, I mean, there were very few Black people I knew when I was growing up who didn't work or who were on welfare. Most of them had working class kind of jobs. And they're people who tend to be cynical. And and in some ways, Malcolm spoke to them and to that class. And in other ways, they were very cynical of him and very cynical of Islam and very cynical of the Muslims and rather thought this was some kind of hustle and was rather thinking of Malcolm as in some way having some kind of hustle going, you know, that this was some kind of slick hustle or something like that to get some money out of the community. You know, they used to talk all the time about, you know, well, when you go to the Muslim temple, you know, or you go to one of their big rallies. All they do, ten times during the time they're having the rally, is pass these big white buckets around for you to throw money in. So, and all you ever see those guys doing on the corner, man. All they're doing is pushing Mohammed Speaks and bean pies and like that. So you know, people criticize them for that. So the very kinds of things, the very kind of industry that the Muslims showed. Was met, I think, with a kind of paradoxical eye. On the one hand, people did respect them because, you know, they did clean up their followers and they did show a lot of industry. But on the other hand, people saw it as a kind of hustle.
You've written that your attitude changed as you got older about Malcolm X and his rhetoric started to seem out of date. When did you start feeling that way and why?
There were dimensions of Malcolm X in the book. I mean, there were dimensions about Malcolm X that never came out in the book that to me seemed as though they ought to be addressed in some way. So I would say by the time I got to my middle 20s, the autobiography of Malcolm X was a book that I no longer trusted. And the rhetoric associated with, you know, that kind of intense Black consciousness was something that had become suspect for me, too. It becomes suspect for me because I was kind of thinking that it seemed to be another way of creating a sort of prison out of race, and this began to concern me. But one of the major thing that really began to concern me about Malcolm X was that after I read the book closely, it occurred to me that the whole business that really the book turns on in some way, when he goes to the second conversion, he finds this non-racialist Islam. It after having read the book closely, even before having read other kinds of sources which supported what I discovered, just from the autobiography itself, I discovered that was fake. I mean, that was absolutely fake. I mean, there was no kind of magical conversion like that took place in Mecca that I suddenly discovered the non-racialist Islam. He knew about a non-racialist Islam for a very long time. It's just that for a long time, it was convenient for him to ignore the fact that Islam was not a race-based religion. And for a long time, the discovery of that bothered me, and I was unable to really deal with Malcolm for a long time because I was unable to appreciate the complexity of that discovery. It just at first made me just see him as being dishonest in the book, as being just utterly suspect.
And now how do you see it?
In the last year or so, I've been able to go back to Malcolm with a renewed interest in the complexities of the man, after having been away from the book for a while, because it occurred to me that there's something awfully complex and awfully interesting about a man who I think was basically an honest man, who wound up being caught in a situation where he was preaching something that he knew wasn't true, which I think a whole lot of people who preach some kind of religious line, in fact, do.
My guest is Gerald Early, and he chairs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington State University in St. Louis, and he's the editor of the forthcoming anthology Lure and Loathing, Essays on Race, Identity, and the Ambivalence of Assimilation. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gerald Early. You chair the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington State University in St. Louis. In your recent essay on Malcolm X, you wrote that Malcolm X is the ideological standard that's being offered up by your students who are accusing you of not being black enough to head the African and Afro-American Studies Department. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, Malcolm is, insofar as being somebody who, said that black people are African and, we ought to connect up as Africans and all that sort of stuff. And I think, basically there's somebody that a lot of young people feel that anybody who runs an African Afro-American Studies program should have that same kind of ideological bent. Malcolm was this model of blackness, But the whole idea, I think as I've talked about in the article and probably could have been developed more, that among black people, generational strife, and a part of this is just generational. The generational strife among black people is very serious business. And also that black generations, younger black generations, always tend to accuse older blacks of not being sufficiently black, that you kind of sold out and all that sort of stuff. And that kind of, there's always that kind of tension that that exists. But Malcolm was a very... I think Malcolm has become a very attractive figure. I mean, I use Malcolm there, because I think that, the kids kind of wanted somebody who was, who would be coming out of that sort of, not only that sort of ideological bag, but would be that kind of personality, someone who was going to stand up and tell the white folks, someone who's going to stand up to the white administration and tell them you're racist dogs, and, you need to do something about this program, and that sort of thing. Malcolm, because he was very bold in his confrontation, that makes him a very romantic figure to young people, because he was so bold in telling white people bluntly what he thought and accusing them of racism and so forth. And that's just tremendously attractive, and to someone who speaks his mind like that, and most of us go around in life sort of mincing our words and all that sort of thing, and being very careful about, well, I don't want to say this to this person and all that sort of stuff. And so, we always wind up seeming as though we're shuffling and compromising and everything.
So do you think that there are parts of Afrocentrism that have become identified in a way with anti-intellectualism?
Oh, sure, definitely. The interesting thing about that, of course, is that the Afrocentric movement is a movement that prides itself so much on being intellectual. But when ideology, sort of rules the day, and you have difficulty in having a variety of points of view expressed, you're essentially talking about an anti-intellectual movement. There's been a great diversity of thinking among black people historically in this country. and you know, that diversity must be respected. As a relative of mine always used to say, all roads lead to Rome, and all roads must be taken. And you know, that that frame of mind, you know, that has to be respected. Afrocentrism essentially wants to create an ideological vision so that all black people can be united. In essence, Afrocentrism is the age-old, is an expression of the age-old desire among black people that we be united with, on the basis of something other than having shared a common oppression.
I guess you see this kind of dual aspect of racial community, that on the one hand, it gives this really strong sense of belonging and a strong sense of community and pride and ancestry, but on the other hand, it can be stifling. It can be a conforming influence.
Oh, sure. It can be stifling. It can be philistine. It can be a lot of things. It can be intensely anti-intellectual, as any kind of community. I mean, as any, you know, and, you know, I'm not...
Right, right.
Pointing out just, I mean, anything. I mean, the Catholic Church, I mean, anything can be like that once you get...
And any kind of, like, ethnic identity movement.
Right. Any sorts of movements, once they become, once they reach this certain kind of dogma level or orthodoxy level, they can become enormously stifling because they become frightened of any kind of dissent. But you can have intellect, and you can have intellectual movement, and you can have... intellectual flowering without dissent. I mean, the whole essence of intellectualism is dissent. Afrocentrism has started out as a dissent movement in relation to white intellectualism, Eurocentrism, whatever you want to call it. But it's now placed itself as a kind of orthodoxy. And I think naturally it would produce a dissent of its own. It has to, in some ways, in order for it to even survive, it has to produce this kind of dissent of its own. But ethnic identification in that way can be extremely stifling and extremely dangerous.
I know you find it paradoxical that Malcolm X, one of the kind of creators of Afrocentric thought, has really told a uniquely American story, in the sense that the story of reinvention is the kind of quintessential American story.
Yeah, it is. And that is really, really interesting about Malcolm. But the whole business of, you know, reinventing himself, the whole business of conversion, the whole everything about, you know, this whole preoccupation, the way he's even preoccupied with his identity is very American. In many respects, it's just a particular subset of American, that is Black American, that comes out. But Americans are pretty preoccupied, pretty self-absorbed with the whole quest of identity and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, just the idea of a quest for identity to people in a lot of cultures, a lot of other cultures, is just odd or, you know, different, or, you know, they'll just say, well, that's American. Yes, he wrote a very American story, which is why, one of the reasons I believe the book has had the kind of popularity it's had, and one of the reasons why I think the movie will probably be very popular and successful, and a lot of people will go see it, is that, you know, underneath it all, despite all the race talk and everything else, is that, you know, it's an American story.
If your students sometimes feel that you're, quote, not black enough to chair the department, does that ever cause you this kind of to self-examine yourself and see, well, am I not? I mean, what does that mean? And should I change? And if I changed, how would I change?
Oh, sure. It does that all the time, because I think there's always a certain amount of examining going on with any black person. I think especially when you're dealing with, if you're largely operating in a white world and you're largely thinking about your race consciousness, you're thinking about, you know, some kind of integrity that you have as a black person and so forth, that I think, yes, you're constantly thinking about, you're constantly thinking about that sort of thing. I think you think about you think about that as much as Puritans used to think about whether they were saved or not. Yes, you think about, have I sold out, or have I, you know, maybe I have some, you know, I think that, you, of course you do. And so I think that in some ways I've tried to meet the students even more so in an effort to show, you know, that I really do have their interest at heart, in an effort to show that I really am sympathetic to them and so forth, and sympathetic to their concerns and so forth. I really tried to reach out to them in some ways because of that. And so, you know, those sorts of things, you know, that sort of thing does affect you. You know, because as a successful black person, you get to a point where your success has meaning only because you want to be able to show younger black people something, that teach them something, that just makes your life have some kind of meaning, and you feel as though what you've achieved has significance in some way because you're able to guide or mentor some younger black people in your life as some kind of an example. So naturally, you're very upset and distraught and disturbed if that turns out to not be the case and you're being rejected.
Mm-hmm.
In some way. But as I said, I think this is a kind of paradox in black life, and this is a kind of strife that occurs in black life because, you know, there's always been this tension of younger and older. You know, if you just look back at the civil rights movement and the black power movement that came out of it, the black power movement that came out of it was largely younger blacks saying to the older black civil rights establishment, we don't like the way you guys are doing. In fact, we think it's useless, and what you've achieved is useless, and we're going to go out here and we're going to do this thing the way it should be done. And you know, that's just a very dramatic kind of broad cultural example of that kind of tension. And I'm sure it made the older black leaders angry, but I think even more than that, it probably hurt them. I mean, they probably felt very hurt by it.
Gerald Early chairs the African and African American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. He is the editor of the forthcoming anthology Lure and Loathing, Essays on Ethnicity and Race in America. His essay on Malcolm X is in the December issue of Harper's. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.